2005 and 8:35, and House Committee on Trade and Economic Development will come to order, and we are going to have a public hearing on both bills, House Bill 2349 and then House Bill 2234. Since this is the similar bills, we are going to hear it at the same time together. So I'd like to open a public hearing on House Bill 2349 and House Bill 2234.
Mr. Chairman, House Bill 2234 increases from 4 to 10 the maximum number of electronic commerce enterprise zones that may be designated by the Economic and Community Development Department. It would take effect on the 91st day after signing die. House Bill 2349 reduces the minimum private investment requirement from $100 million to $50 million for negotiating property tax exemptions under the Strategic Investment Program. It reduces the minimum private investment requirement from $25 million to $12.5 million in rural areas. Both of these bills have to do with tax incentives, so both of them have subsequent referral to the Revenue Committee.
Okay, with that, I'd like to call, who am I calling?
Well, why don't you call the Economic Community Development Department and let them decide who they want to send up.
Come on up from the OECDD.
This is our friend.
Okay. Well, I will let you decide who is going to speak first, and then welcome. Thank you very much for coming. Appreciate it.
Let me first introduce myself. I'm Ron Fox. I'm the manager of the Business Development Division for the Oregon Economic and Community Development Department. And today I'm going to really set in for Mike Sulzgiver, who is our Legislative Affairs Manager, who has a serious case of laryngitis. And I'm not sure he's working on that right now to see if he can get his voice back. But in the interim, I will just sit here. Victoria and Art will do most of our presentation.
Thank you.
Good morning, Chairman Lim and the committee. My name is Victoria Pruitt. I'm with the Oregon Economic and Community Development Department. I'm the Market Development Manager and have oversight over the incentive programs. I'd like to introduce Art Fish, who is the Tax and Business Incentive Coordinator for the state and for the department. And as I go through the presentation that we have today, which is a high overview of business tax incentives for the state, for detailed questions, I will probably be deferring to Art. Okay? What I'd like to do as we start off is to essentially kind of give you an overview of why incentives and address that, talk about taxation itself and give a high level, talk about the tools that we have within the state as far as incentives, do a wrap-up, and then offer up some additional information that we have for you. So with that, why incentives? Currently, the marketplace is a global economic climate. I think all of you are probably well aware of that, but it's becoming more and more competitive. That's not just for businesses. It's also for states and also for counties and localities to compete for business and to economically develop their bases. Businesses look to the bottom line. They're looking at costs for 5 years, 10 years, 15, and 20 years. They aren't just focused on present, and so they're looking for the long run, and we believe that the state needs to focus there as well in regard to tax incentives. The state needs to generate investment in jobs to build higher-paying tax base and industrial and traded sector companies that will be residing here and growing our economy. The bottom line is return on investment to the state, and that's net gain overall to the economy as well as growing state revenues. So with that, what I'd like to do is move into essentially a review of business tax incentives. Overall and generally, we have property taxes, which are local, which I'm sure you're all familiar with because you're paying them. There's an annual assessment on capital and everything down to paper clips. This is an ad valorem tax, which is an assessment that's taxed based on the value of the property, not on how many widgets you have on the shelf. Mm-hmm. So with that, inventory is accepted, vehicles, and only new property is exempted. There's income and excise taxes on state profits. There's specialized taxes and local fees and SDCs. Personal income tax, which impacts individuals, entrepreneurs, small businesses, executives, and the general cost of labor. Taxes we don't have, general sales and use tax, gross receipts, occupancy, inventory, and some other business-related taxes that many other states do have, but Oregon doesn't. So with that high level on business taxes, I want to address the first tax incentive program that we oversee, which is enterprise zones. There are 49 of them currently in the state. And by statute, no more than that can exist at one time. They were established in 1985, and they're located in the economically lagging areas that usually have high unemployment and low wage, and they offer tax relief for new private capital investment. The newest addition to that is the rural renewable energy development zones that were added in 2003. The system's sunset in 2009, and that was extended by legislative action in 1995. There's local sponsorship by the counties, and 89 cities are currently involved. The zones are discrete areas, so they're limited by size and distance. The local area must meet economic hardship criteria to be designated as such. And each zone does expire by its 11th year after designation. The zones have proved to be very useful, including in the rural areas. They tend to be a unique resource to local communities and are unmatched by other business incentives that are offered. It gives visibility to local development efforts, and by forgiving property taxes, the E-zones have led to thousands of new jobs being added in the rural communities. If you'll turn to page 6, it'll give you a diagram of the enterprise zones around the state. And you'll notice as we flip through the pages that there are some icons, squares, triangles, lightning bolts. Those are all tied and significant because they're reflected on the map to designate where these zones are located. The dark area through the center is refers to the Butlerville area, and I'll address that later. So the standard exemption in the zones. New additional plant and equipment, not land, are 100% exempt from property taxation. And this is normally assessed on significant investments. The exemption period starts after the project is placed in service, and it can be preceded by up to 2 years of unfinished property or work in progress time. There's a 3-year period that's automatic with a new full-time hiring, and that has to be at least a 10% increase for eligible firms. And those firms are involved in manufacturing, shipping, and, of course, traded sector. This can be extended for 4 to 5 years and depends on high compensation and local agreement by city and county sponsors. Sponsors offer fee waivers and other local incentives as a central part to the zone package. So the localities and the counties have a great deal of control in the enterprise zone process. Within that are long-term rural incentives, mostly non-urban enterprise zones that have chronically high unemployment and low income. These were began in 1997 as an effort to lure the company by the name of Nucor. They really made a usable beginning only after 1999 and 2001. They're currently available in 13 enterprise zones. It's a blanket exemption on new facilities for 7 to 15 years. The local jurisdiction must certify it, and it is conditioned on a written agreement that sets the period of exemption. Minimums are for investment size, new jobs, and average compensation of workforce. Besides the property tax exemption, there is a corporate tax credit of 5 to 15 years. This does require the governor's approval, and it's based on the gross payroll that the company brings. It hasn't been commonly used so far, even though it's a great benefit, but there is current interest by certain projects, so we're hopeful on that. Another designation that falls within the zones is the e-commerce designation. It was created in 2001. There are only 4 statewide: Burns and Hines, Medford, Northeast Portland, and Roseburg. You need to have a significant business-related transactions that are occurring over the Internet to participate in the e-commerce designations. It depends on a use standard for the enterprise zone exemption, for which the firm eligibility and personal property is a little less restrictive. The big deal here is also income tax credit. There's a 25% capital cost, which goes up to $2 million for any single year of e-commerce investment, and that also has a five-year deferral for each credit. So if you don't have profits that can be taxed, that can be deferred later to a year when you do. The next page 10, moves us into the SIP program, which is the Strategic Investment Program. This is served for large capital investments, such as Intel, LSI Logic, Fujitsu Microchip, and IDT. Those have been the ones that have used the SIP program in the past approximately 14, 15 years. It's available statewide. And there is a lower rural threshold that was established in 2003. For 15 years, the property value is exempt in excess of the threshold. The threshold starts at $25 million in rural areas and $100 million in urban areas. The exemption threshold is then increased by 3% per year. Local governments negotiate and approve the project, and the Oregon Economic Community Development Commission's determination allows that exemption. The business does pay annual community service support fees of 25% of the tax savings, and they may face other requirements or fees established at the local and county levels. This is up to $500,000 and $2 million in urban locations, and it actually represents a huge cash infusion to those localities when these projects do go through, because it's fairly immediate. So far, the semiconductor and fabs are the ones who have taken advantage of this, and I mentioned some of those companies. $21 billion have been invested, 6,000 jobs that have been directly attributed to that, and approximately 11,000 that are indirect through contractors and other economic growth for additional jobs. A simple test of revenue to the state on this would be to essentially take those 6,000 jobs, times it by average wage, and times it by the net personal income tax that the state would realize. If you took an average wage of approximately $40,000, which many of these jobs are you know, again, a third over that, you would end up with a net of $12 million annually to the state just in personal income tax revenue.
Okay, hold on. Any questions at this point yet? Okay, please go ahead.
Thank you. The state actually gives up very little with the SIP program because it is controlled at the county and it's a property tax program. So moving on to abating property taxes. One program is the CIP, Construction Period Exemption, which is considered construction in process. This has been available since 1959. It's allowed for up to 2 years, and it's often used with the SIP program and a special interface with property covered by the Standard Enterprise Zone Exemption. Utilities and hotel resort properties are not eligible for this one, however. Other property tax abatements that are non-business related involve vertical housing with the vertical housing development zones. This is designed to encourage urban development and redevelopment, residential upstories and special districts, and essentially it gives exemption on new structure for incremental value. There are also non-business related tax abatements for rural medical facilities and other facilities that are offered by the state. Certain tax credits that come as credit against income taxes. For advanced telecom facilities, there's a 20% investment in last mile connections. This is administered by the Oregon Economic and Community Development Department. There are energy savings tax credits, 35% of investment in energy conservation and sustainable buildings. This is actually administered by the Department of Energy. And then there's a dependent care credit based on 50% of expenses up to $2,500 per benefiting employee, which many single moms and parents utilize. To continue on.
Before you move on.
Okay.
Since we are giving out a lot of tax credit or incentive to the businesses in the enterprise zone area, do you have some complaints from the company already existed, which they are not getting much tax credit?
Mm-hmm.
And I would like to know what complaint, if there has been any.
Mm-hmm. If businesses within the zone, I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman Lynn, and the committee, businesses within the zone are eligible if there's incremental investment and if they want to participate. So there's not a competition that's going on, and it doesn't act as a disincentive for them.
Okay.
Is there anything you'd like to add to that, Art?
Yes, thank you, Victoria. Chair Lynn, members of the committee, my name is Arthur Fish, Business Incentives Coordinator with the Economic Community Development Department. A pleasure to be here again, as usual. I just note that, to answer the question, that a great many existing companies already in the state, much less already in the enterprise zone, do use this. We have approximately a little over 100 so companies that are using the program at the moment, or in the last year, I should say. And, you know, which is actually a fairly low number, but only about 25 to 30 of them were really new to the enterprise zone. So a lot of them are companies that are expanding, mostly smaller companies, but some big ones expand too and use the zone as well as, you know, new companies.
Okay, thank you. Representative Buckley.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just before we move on, I just wanted to ask questions on the last two points were raised on energy savings and dependent care credit. Can you give me a rough answer on the use of these programs? Do we have, of the 100 companies you mentioned, are companies using the energy credits? Are they using the dependent care credit?
Chairman Lynn and Representative Buckley, I'm going to let Art respond.
Thank you.
Chair Lim, Representative Buckley, members of the committee, Gilbert Fish. You know, we really might have to ask another department to get a lot more detail about it. What we rely on is the tax expenditure report, and in the back of the materials are, we do list, at least for the energy thing, the energy tax credit, the number of amount that was claimed in the past biennium. How many companies are using that or not, I'm not sure how many they've certified each year, but I'm sure it's available in the tax expenditure report, and we could certainly investigate and ask and check with the people at the Department of Energy to see if we can get more background, if you like.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Okay.
Appreciate it if you could provide that information
to the whole
each one of us.
To the full committee, sure.
Yes. Thank you.
Okay.
Chairman Lim and the committee. I'll continue. One additional tax credit is on pollution control. This involves diverse projects. 35% of the investment in the facility with certain special criteria. And this particularly applies to green projects that are involved in the enterprise zone. And this one is administered by the Department of Department of Environmental Quality. I'll get that one out. Also managed by the DEQ is a new program for low nitrous oxide truck engines where tax credits are available for truckers using specialized engines. There are also research tax credits available, 5% of annual research cost. This links to the IRS program. It's currently capped at $500,000, and it's to go up to $750,000 in 2006. There is currently a bill dropped, I think it was 2368, which would take that up to $1 million. Federal tax credits, of course, including for the hiring of certain disadvantaged workers, and that one is managed through the Employment Department. So we're giving you a broad overall, not just what we cover, but tax incentives across the state. On page 14, moving right along, our business development taxable incomes exemptions. This relates to the Butler bill. It began in 2001 and broadened somewhat in 2003. It has not yet been used yet, but we are hopeful that that will end up being utilized. There's project-specific income, which is subtracted from state taxable income for a period of 10 years. It's available currently only in 7 counties, meaning certain economic statistics. You must also be within the urban growth boundary, and the city population has to be less than 15,000 or an industrially zoned site. There's pre-certification, and there's also local veto for cause. To qualify, it has to be a unique operation for that company within the state and to the local economy. It has to have a minimum of 5 full-time hires and certain minimum compensation that's part of that requirement. There are statutes and discretion that have oversight for tax incentives. Benefits are mostly defined by law, constitutional, and for constitutional and other reasons. There's local discretion in negotiations about and beyond the tax incentives. And these are managed, again, at the county and local levels, and so it does have a direct impact. SIP is county approved pursuant to agreement with the specific business firm. Certain enterprise zone cases are locally sponsored, and the cities or city and county are involved there as well. To essentially summarize, I want to go back to why incentives. For businesses, again, it's the bottom line. They're planning out 5, 10, 15, 20 years. For large corporations like Intel, they're looking at shifting assets. Do they grow here? Do they grow in some other state? And we want them to grow here. From the state's aspect, we have a stake in assisting businesses here and helping them to grow and expand as well as start and locate here. And for us, it's also the base of revenues and revenues to the state. Globally, it's a competitive environment, and again, I emphasize that is not just for the businesses out there. It's for state economies and local economies as well. The return on investment that we get, again, tax revenues that would not otherwise be expected. There's long-run expansion of property tax base and personal incomes, direct impact on jobs, construction, additional suppliers, and other multiplier effects to the economy. It bolsters manufacturing and traded sector commerce that underpins the economy and provides for well-paying jobs. This also has a relatively low impact to the communities as far as service costs. Sometimes it creates a crunch if growth is rapid, but overall those things can be compensated for. And the cash to the counties through community service fees and also increased property values is another thing to be considered. And the net gain in ROI to the state is that's based in revenue. In closing, I'd like to actually offer some additional information that we have to offer to the committee, some examples of what's being done in other states, as well as an article for a recent request in Idaho for strategic investment by that state. So hopefully you'll find that of interest. And as that's being handed out, I'd like to essentially leave you with a basic comparison and a bold comparison, as well as a next step. The basic comparison is that incentives, whether it's at the state level or for a consumer product, are very similar. Whether it's a grocery coupon, an auto rebate, or a tax incentive based at the state level, there's value and there's benefit. It's not that a producer of a product gives their product away. They don't. They realize the added value and the profit they will make in the long run. As far as a bold comparison, I'd like to offer something that was shared with me last night by someone that I admire. And that was a bold comparison that over the last 15 years, with $21 billion in private sector investment and the creation of approximately 17,000 in jobs, I really doubt that there's been a greater investment made by the state in that period of time, excluding roads and transportation. But if you look at that investment overall, it's huge to our economy. Next steps, to identify the next generation of strategic incentives to drive Oregon's economic development. Oregon is far behind the curve on supporting non-asset-based businesses. And so our focus now is to incent companies that are structured on innovation and knowledge-based capital. And I thank you for your time, and would like to take any questions.
Any questions? Representative Morali.
Yeah, I'd like to ask about enterprise zones. Is there a good reason or is there no good reason why there are limits to the number of enterprise zones that we can have and to the length of time that they can be in existence?
Chairman Lynn, Representative Riley. Again, I'm going to defer to Art because he has the history.
Thank you, Victoria. Chairman Lynn, Representative Riley, members of the committee. The reason there's, originally there was 30, but it's been increased over time. The reasons for it, I think, are good, but, there's obviously, reasons for fewer or more, I could imagine. Right now,
We pretty much satisfied, I think, the demand to, you know, start out. But the reasons, I think, to limit it are to provide, obviously, a special benefit for certain areas that they can have for themselves, that, you know, they justify more than some other area that they're committed to, I suppose. It is also something that not everybody supports, and so I think, you know, part of it's a political decision about, you know, what's the right number, and when the legislature in 1995, as Victoria noted, decided to reauthorize the entire enterprise zone system, they provided for this sort of, you know, they let the zones terminate after 10 years as was provided for, but kind of allowed them to be recycled and give other communities the opportunity to get them and so forth. And so, you know, in retrospect, I think the legislature has created a very good program and set things very wisely, but I can't say that, you know, there's any you know, magic or particular way of defining what is exactly the right number or not, but it's been a good balance, I feel.
Thank you.
Okay. Yes, Representative Vice Chair Mokley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I had some conversations with PDC that I found very interesting this last interim, and specifically we're talking about the relatively overall low corporate tax burden on average in Oregon versus other states, and how little that does to attract corporations. And part of the conversation from the PDC person's point of view, I haven't asked them if I can out their thinking, so I won't say who it was, but was that essentially our rate is low in part because of the variety of credits and deductions we have, but that corporations thinking about coming to Oregon might not qualify for them specifically and might not be confident they'll be there in the future. And the more I thought about it, raises questions about, as a strategy, does it make more sense to simply have a much lower overall rate that affects everyone, so it's not campaigning for the most recent tax credit that affects your particular industry or your particular piece of property or your particular location, and also takes communities out of the mode of competing against each other intensely, because we know that county is going to offer that. It used to be that state is going to offer that, so maybe our state should offer it, but now it's that county might offer it, so then we're going to have to offer it. And so I've just wondered if you all within the Economic Development Department have pondered the alternative of what it would look like to have simply a very low rate of taxation, producing more or less the same revenues we produce now in the corporate area, rather than having all these little pieces that pitches communities against each other, and corporations are not sure they'll really benefit if they come here, and so on and so forth. So it's just kind of a philosophical inquiry.
Chairman Glenn, members of the committee, again, I'm Ron Fox. I manage the Business Development Group. Representative Markley, we haven't engaged in that evaluation that you described. We do regularly evaluate the corporate excise tax or comparable tax burden for Oregon compared with other states. And as you mentioned in your comments, Oregon's corporate excise tax rate, which I believe is at 5.6%, is relatively low in comparison to the base rate for other states. While other states, as you know, Washington does not have a corporate excise tax, they have a business and operations tax, commonly called a B&O tax, which essentially taxes gross rather than profits. And our Oregon corporate excise tax has also been adjusted by the legislature to give advantage to corporations whose goods and services are exported from the state, so that the calculation of corporate excise tax is based predominantly on a sales factor associated with the amount of the business the industry produces goods and services and are sold outside the state of Oregon. I in answer to your general question, I think corporations, as Victoria mentioned in her opening statement, they really focus in on the total bottom line over a long period of time and are somewhat hesitant to consider tax deferrals that have a term associated with them, either in the form of a sunset provision or lasting for a period of time. As most businesses make their investment decisions intending it to be a long-term business strategy. So I think generally Oregon's corporate excise tax structure is a moderate rate. I think we generally score in the bottom quarter of the states in terms of corporate excise tax rates, but they look at sort of your description of a standard flat rate with few adjustments or exceptions, I think I'd defer to more of an evaluation by businesses there, more closer to their impacts on their corporate tax structure.
Could I add a few points? I'd just add, I believe Ron's right. I mean, we are one of the lower cost states, and one can say whether that helps us a lot or a little, but I think it does. I think we do benefit from our generally good business climate in terms of taxation. The high personal income tax rate does have its effect as well, though. That's sort of our bugaboo here, of course. We'd really, compared to a lot of other states, they tend to have higher taxes and a lot more sort of bells and whistles and things than we do. I mean, our tools are, I think, much more limited, and they're much more set in statute in a way that doesn't provide for the type of, interjurisdictional competition, if you will. The enterprise zones are really our key tool out there, and localities make a decision, and most of them know where they stand now as far as having gotten one, if they can get one, and the areas that generally don't qualify, like the metro, the Portland suburbs, generally aren't that interested as far as I can tell, and SIP has had very, fairly narrow application so far, so I hope that helps.
Great. The Vice Chair Broom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think your comments are excellent, and I think Representative Merkley's question is a good question too. It's good to keep in mind that yes, when it comes to corporate excise taxes, Oregon is average, a little better than average. But we also, I think, when we're talking about that, and I think it lends credit to what you're advocating for today, that Oregon has a unique industry blend. Oregon has a predominance of heavy industry, heavy manufacturing industry, and high-tech manufacturing, hence the Intel. So really the taxes that affect Oregon corporations the most, especially those that create the most jobs, that create the highest wage jobs, are capital taxes, and I think it's important to remember that we have the highest capital gains tax rate in the nation. So when we talk about corporate excise taxes is one thing, we need to also remember that we have the highest capital gains tax rate in the nation. We also have high property taxes, and that's why the enterprise zone concept is such a good concept for these heavy manufacturers, for the Intels of the world, for the green buyers of the world. Huge investments in property and capital expenditures and real estate, and offering these sorts of tax abatements to the enterprise zones are absolutely critical to getting these sorts of industries. Our committee was in the Dalles last Friday, and everybody's heard about the Google coming to Oregon, which is fantastic. I sat down with the gentleman who was with the port of the Dalles, and he wanted to, basically, how did you get Google was my question to him. And he said three things. One, we don't have a sales tax, and that was very important to Google. Two was that it was shovel-ready land, and I give credit to the governor for having that land ready to go, and that was important for Google because they needed to make the decision right away. But third, and I think which really goes back to lend credit and support to what you're advocating for, was that they're in an enterprise zone, and it was a property tax abatement, and those three factors were the difference between Oregon getting Google and some other state getting Google.
Thank you. Okay. Representative Dallum.
A question. And I guess, Ron, I'll direct it to you, and if I'm in the wrong place, you'll straighten me out. And I'm going to cross out a lot of the questions I'm going to ask.
It will depend upon how tough the question is.
I'll try and toss you a tough ball, but when we go looking for industry, if we use the metaphor of a quiver full of arrows, we want all the things that Representative Broom just talked about. But the biggest thing about our taxing arrow is stability, and how we can structure our tax burden so that it, when compared to others, we're inviting. And that's what I came away from the testimony with, and I'm looking, and the answer is yes. So what we want, if we're going to make that arrow as attractive as we can in our quiver, then stability and how we compare with others. And this positions us to be stable and to be competitive. Thank you.
Chairman, I'm Representative Dallum. I would agree wholeheartedly with your comment. I think what businesses that we interface with tell us, they recognize that it's stable, there's always incremental increase in costs. But what they want is to be able to put into their business evaluation a predictability in their business costs. They want to be able to project their profitability over a long period of time, because they're looking at return on investment requirements that they must meet in order to justify these. So the predictability or stability, as two words, would definitely describe the expectation that business looks at, in addition to a competitive overall cost of business. And again, Oregon has many attributes that make it one of the competitive states in the United States.
Follow up. Then when we talk about changing the corporate tax structure in any of the venues, and if we use the arrow analogy, does our quarry become nervous when we're talking about bouncing around, doing this, doing that? Does that make them harder to capture, just the simple fact that we're talking about changing our tax structure?
Chairman Lim, Representative Dallum, I think I would go back to the two points that you made earlier. It's the overall cost implications of those adjustments and the long-term predictability that would be associated, the ability for a business to, if you will, put on a spreadsheet and project out into a 15 or 20-year net present value evaluation. I mean, I'll expand just briefly. Whether it is an existing business contemplating an expansion, or it's a new business considering, or the vision that we have and what we know we are dealing with is a business that puts the costs of doing business, including capital acquisitions, labor costs, taxes, all the considerations, they put it on a spreadsheet, and they project those costs over whatever their internalized projection is, 15, 20 years, and calculate a net present value. And that is a key factor in a decision to expand an existing business in Oregon or to make an initial investment. So the ability of that business to be able to put that information on a 15-year spreadsheet and make a decision based on that consideration is very important. And I would say anything that would give them speculation as to stability and predictability would be a disadvantage for Oregon.
Thank you. Must have been an easy question.
let's hold on at this time, and when they present more information on this, that it might give us more light or more questions. And so who's going to go to the next?
For additional questions, Chairman Lim?
No, for the presentation. Are you done your presentation?
On the presentation, what we have remaining is just additional information for the committee.
Okay.
So you can go through it. If you have additional questions for us out of that, you can certainly contact us directly, and we'll be supplying information back.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, Chairman Lim, and members of the committee, I guess included in the additional information, and I'll go kind of work backwards, the final page of the presentation, I know Strategic Investment Program has been one of the incentives that you have consideration before you. On the back page of the presentation we presented to you are the firms that have received and are utilizing the Strategic Investment Program. The investment made to garner that incentive, and the direct jobs, which is the number we reported earlier, and then the year in which that SIP grant was made. The bubble charts that you see on pages 18, 19, and I think page 20 are some internalized documents that we use internally in the department to to sort of help us focus on the kind of business investments that we want to encourage in the state of Oregon. As you'll see on page 18 as an example, the types of investments can be high level of human capital. That's people jobs without a lot of capital investment. A business with a very high capital investment, and then low levels of physical or human capital. And what we're looking at, and Victoria made reference to this, is that we have a good toolbox full of capital investment type inducements or incentives and that's what we are really talking about today with you. So these are just documents that we've used to sort of look at what we have in our current quiver, as Representative Dallin alluded to, and how do those arrows match up with the kind of investment, both by industry type and sector, that we would want to have make new investments or additional investments in Oregon.
Are you done?
Yes. Chairman Lim and the committee. We do have some information to present on House Bill 2234 that might be of assistance to you.
And it's a yes. Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Okay. Did you call me? Okay. Representative Nelson.
Thank you. Very much. Mr. Fox and Mr. Fish and Ms. Pritt, how does the Economic Development Department, can you work with these entities to, you know, help them get through this paperwork that reminds me of the veteran benefits of the federal government? Greatly complicated. Is there a charge from your department to assist these businesses?
Chairman Lim, Representative Nelson, no. It is a part of our mission to assist existing Oregon businesses and prospective businesses in the traded sector category of the economy to be sustained, grow, and come to Oregon. So we do that as a course of our department's activities.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
Would it be possible to get the list on the back page of this document that Victoria handed out? The last one, it says page 3 of 37. I don't know what the 37 relates to. It's the summary where it lists 94 separate business development projects, 36 in 2004, and 102 in proposed to be completed. Is it possible that we could get a list of those and what areas they are, and who their sponsor is?
Chairman Lim, Representative Nelson, we're happy to actually deliver that today.
Great.
Chairman Lim, Representative Nelson, members of the committee, I do have with me, that is page 3 of 37 from our little activity report that you can find online on our webpage. And it does list by enterprise zone and provide more detail about those investments. It's broken down in the summary here. But if you'd like to get an actual list of each company, we don't actually put that out on the public.
That would be so wonderful.
Public wavelengths, but we can certainly provide that to the committee.
I think, Mr. Chair, if I could just.
Yes, please.
Please, I think, Art, that would be beneficial because many of us are unaware of the types of businesses that have been attracted because of this program. Might help us in helping our communities.
Well, yes, I certainly appreciate that. And I think, as you'll notice, Chairman Lim, Representative Nelson, members of the committee, it is a very diverse number of businesses making very different sized, they vary in size in terms of the investments and so forth. And some of that's captured in some of the graphics that are in the activity report. The list we have is just I can just kind of make a spreadsheet printout. It just gives the name of the company, and sometimes that isn't always that helpful as far as knowing what they do, but it's best we can provide.
Mr. Chair, if we could just indicate the type of service or products they would provide. I'm curious why, when we have so much emphasis on tourism, why are we exempting hotels and tourist attractions in this program. I read it on one of the pages.
The Chair Liam, Representative Nelson, Manager of the Committee. The only, they can actually, hotel, motel, resort, destination resorts are eligible businesses in enterprise zones for the standard exemption if the zone has chosen to do that. And I think about 31 of the 49 chose have opted for that. And if you look on the map, they're the ones with the little asterisks by their name, if you can see that. And what you're referring to is the construction process exemption, and that doesn't help hotel motels. The only thing they can, you know, and since it was created, I can't justify it, I'm sorry, but since that was created in 1959, if you're a non-manufacturing type producer, you can't use it if you take more than 12 months to build your facility. So that kind of excludes most hotels. They usually go up within a year. So that's just a fact of the law, but we do in the enterprise zones allow most of the sponsors have taken the option of including hotel motels for the very reason of encouraging tourism type development.
Thank you.
Okay, Representative Buckley, you did have a question.
Yes, I did. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
First, just a quick comment. We received a lot of information from the various programs, WorkSource, Oregon, the Oregon Business Plan. And it's good to see how these all come together. So on the issue of stability, I would say the Oregon Business Plan does present some good ideas in terms of the stability of state services, including education, including a qualified workforce, as well as how the tax programs work in the state. Victoria, you were kind enough to give us a summation on the strategic initiative program of what the net is to the state. In this wealth of information that's been provided, do we have a kind of breakdown that says, here's the state's investment, here's our net gain, what our bottom line is for each one of these programs?
Representative Lynn and Representative Buckley. Actually, that was a bold comparison made by someone, so it was actually commentary. We could get some information together for you to make that kind of comparison. It was a generalized statement, but one that I do believe to be true.
Mr. Chairman, one follow-up, please.
Follow-up.
That would be fantastic, because one of the things that we often get questioned on is, you know, is this investment, like any business would, is this investment the state is making paying off for us? And in terms of the variety of programs, I know you're going to talk about the electronic commerce or enterprise zones in a few minutes, but that is a particular interest. It's only a few years old. Are we seeing returns on this, or are there projections for what we'll see in the future? That would be all tremendous information to have. Okay. And if I can ask you, on the comment about the innovation and knowledge-based services that the focus is turning to, does that include innovation in medical technology and the delivery of healthcare services?
Chairman Levin, Representative Buckley, if Ron wants to...
Chairman Representative Buckley, the reference to knowledge-based or intellectual-based businesses was really a reference to distinguish the kind of business to differentiate between a capital asset-oriented business transaction. As we mentioned earlier, the enterprise zone benefits our property tax, so they're tied to building capital equipment. The strategic investment program is also tied to capital and equipment. Many other states are moving much more aggressively toward incentives based around the human capital that a business creates, and i.e. the personal income that are generated by those jobs. And so when we look at our toolbox and we look at what other states are using in a toolbox, it is these what I will just generally describe as human capital investment incentives. We are very limited, and that's part of what was on those bubble charts that I spoke to earlier. So it's more about the kind of business proposition rather than the type of business it is. They're medical research and development, product development companies tend to be very human capital oriented in their business proposition. They have some capital investment, but not of the magnitude that you would find in a semiconductor manufacturing type business, in a chemical production facility, even a wood products facility, where they have a great deal of investment in capital and equipment.
Thank you.
If I just add here from the term, Chair Lim, represent Buckley, members of the committee, just, and I mean, a lot of the businesses are, whether they can use these capital-based ones that much or not, are in the biomedical and products, and we're seeing an awful lot of that, and sometimes it's surprising how little building structure and equipment they really need to do an awful lot of very cutting-edge work. I just also note on your point about return on investment. In the original handout, the presentation towards the end, on page 23, towards the bottom, are a few check-marked bullets that reflect some number crunching that we do and show how the payback with the enterprise zones, as far as just what we've given out, is we pretty much make up what we give. And that's kind of the analysis that we try to do, is just to show, is it reasonable to assume we break even? And then, can we then attribute, more things to the wages and other things that, we really can't capture. And a lot of this gets into kind of a war of assumptions. Mm-hmm. You have to assume certain, things. But, with very conservative assumptions like we've used here, it's very, I think, very compelling case can be made for a strategic investment program as far as the returns in terms of income tax revenues and economic growth for the state. So I'm sure we'll be able to show you a little diagram of that kind of thing.
Great. Thank you.
Are you done?
But Chairman, I think we are done unless you have additional questions.
Okay, let's discuss at this time House Bill 2234 then. And Andrew, you explained that already, right? And what's the reason that from the increase from 4 to 10, and before that, could you explain to us what the electronic commerce enterprise means?
Thank you, Chair Lim, members of the committee. Again, Arthur Fish with the Oregon Economic and Community Development Department. We handed out just two one-pagers. The first one is sort of our summary sheet of the two things that go on in House Bill 2234. I'm sure you have the one-pager of the bill in front of you as well. And another is sort of a description of the demand that we're seeing, and also a little bit of information about the application round from 2002. That led to the current four designations. Just in summary, of course, I can quite clearly say the department very much urges your favorable consideration of House Bill 2234. The issue is that we do have the four that were authorized, and they are a lot of other enterprise zones that would like this, and it has proven to be very strong tool, especially in the Medford area. The increase to 10 is, again, it's no more magic than the number 4 originally. It's an attempt to create more without maybe going too far as far as people that aren't going to support that kind of thing. An e-commerce enterprise zone is a regular enterprise zone, and a company using one of these needs to qualify, increase employment, and otherwise receive the benefit, if you will, of the 3 to 5 year exemption on new property. The e-commerce element or status does open the door a little bit in terms of, some companies that might not otherwise be eligible, but many of them would be in any other enterprise zone. And it does provide a little more personal property latitude as far as the type of property that can be exempted that's otherwise new. The big thing about these e-commerce zones that make them what they are is an additional tax benefit based on income taxes or corporate excise taxes. It's calculated at 25% of the value of the capital assets that are used for e-commerce, such as servers and phone bank or computer banks and whatever you have that are unique. And it is a very interesting thing. But they still also have to meet the regular enterprise zone requirements of increasing employment, or if they want to get the extended abatement of 4 or 5 years of paying quite a high level of compensation, including benefits. The impact, as I put here on this thing, it's been mostly in the Medford area, but in that case, it's really shown an example that the current four are really, maybe gearing up for, and others would like to have a shot at. And, it has been very effective in our judgment. We feel that, the 12 projects that are already done, there's a bunch more that have been recently done, but the ones that are really in the program already will easily recoup the property tax revenues associated with them in 10 years, and that additional personal income tax receipts from, you know, something like 50% of the jobs, that's the attribution rate I use, will produce about $5 million in income tax revenues, and that's the most if they can use the total tax credit that we'll have subtracted from the general fund otherwise. So I think it's a very good payback. And at the very bottom of the page is a little bit of detail about those qualifying projects that have happened. They didn't happen right away. It took a couple years for the projects to be finished and so forth. So I wouldn't expect any new designations to have any effect on property or revenue for another biennium, just because of the lags in getting them set up and so forth.
Representative Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm still confused. If enterprise zones are such a great idea as they appear to be, why isn't there just one state enterprise zones? Why is it that companies that qualify just outside the enterprise zone don't have the same incentives?
Chairman, Member, Representative Riley, I'll take one swipe at that, and I'll let Victoria or Art follow it. I think the legislature's logic at the time that enterprise zones were put in place was based around an economic distress designation. And that still exists in statute. So, to some degree, the total number of enterprise zones are limited somewhat by that requirement for an economic distress designation, and that really has to do with it. I think the legislature, in considering the creation of the enterprise zones, also, as Art mentioned earlier, wanted to make this a special incentive available in those communities where economic advance and improvement we wanted to encourage or direct. So the existing 49 limit is something that the legislature has put in statute, and we have over time, as Art mentioned, gone from the original 30, which were created at the time that the bill was put in place, to 49, and we actually have a 50th, or is the 49th, we actually have a tribal enterprise zone that's included in that number. Your question, Representative Riley, I think is important to the point that we've limited its applicability to areas of economic distress. In the parlance of the economic development professionals, this is a geospatial-oriented incentive. You have to reside in a meets and bounds definition to receive that benefit, whereas many other incentives, the strategic investment benefit, as an example, does not have a geospatial designation to it, so it can be applied for at any physical location in Oregon that a business might choose to locate.
Thank you.
Okay. Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Fox, this list, or Mr. Fish, anybody, Ms. Pruitt, the enterprise zones that have sought electronic commerce status, are six of these still in the works that would be considered to make this 10?
Go ahead.
Or did we lose them?
Chair Lim, Representative Nelson, members of the committee, there were these various applicants, and the ones that were chosen really, shone forth. It was very good. The ones that are out there that didn't apply are the ones that have generally told us that they are still very interested. And so, if they were more available, I would assume that they would seek application, but there may be others that would too. So we would have to, if we had additional designations, the way it's set up under the laws is have another opportunity for all other enterprise zones to seek those. And I'm quite confident that most of those that did seek it in 2002 would try again in 2006 if the opportunity arose. But there may be others, and we'd have to give them a fair opportunity. So we couldn't just turn it over to the next top six, I guess, from last time. We really couldn't do that.
Mr. Chair?
follow up.
Since this is was an economic distress designation that we came up with in a couple legislatures ago, I guess, my concern is, I guess that these entities had a purpose, and so I'm concerned that if these other 10 were not, you know, part of this, that we did had other options to assist them. Did we?
Chairman Lim, Representative Nelson, what's represented on the page, the enterprise zones that sought issuance of a e-commerce zone, when the original four zones were created, we issued a essentially a request for proposals to all existing enterprise zones. Those listed here were the zones that applied for the original four zones that were available. I think it's fair to say that we have not been able to give them replicable equity. It doesn't exist in the statute, in the laws, and that if the legislature chose to increase the number of eligible e-commerce zones from the current four to what's contained in the bill before you of 10, that we would expect to get many more applications than six, which would make the difference between the existing four and the 10 that is contained in the bill before you. So we recognize that that 10 is probably still does not meet the business firm the market demand for these zones,
right.
But that is that determination is the discretion this committee and the legislature. We've proposed a bill that raised it to 10.
Mr. Chair,
yes.
If I could follow up, but that's
sure.
My concern is that since this has proved to be such a good, viable program, why would we want to just, you know, limit it to 10 when we're so desperate for jobs? And my goodness, to me, I mean, what does it matter how many we have when we have proof through your documentation and the bottom of this page 37, I think, that said we've already returned $2.3 billion back. So is there a need to have a restriction?
Chairman Lim, Representative Nelson, answer the question that's underlying your question, which is why did the department recommend 10 and not 49? I think the answer to that question is we wanted to give the legislature the discretion to decide the degree to which you wish to offer to these communities the ability to offer additional tax incentives or tax deferrals. We have pulled the existing 45 enterprise zones that do not have e-commerce designation and have an indication that at least half of those would be interested, I'll use that word, interested in applying for an enterprise e-commerce zone designation if it were available. And I assume the basis for their application is just as you said. It's to improve their local economy, stimulate business investments, and create additional good jobs.
Okay. Just one final question,
okay.
So that would be my hope in considering this bill when we get there for some type of vote. But what I'm wondering is, what means would you three professionals have? Because I just heard another issue on this very week. If we don't have a transportation system in this state for moving people and goods and services to appropriate clients, we're, you know, kind of banging our head against the wall. So what can we do to work with ODOT or somebody to expedite, you know, a better infrastructure for us? I mean, are y'all working in any programs? It's great to do this, but then when we have that huge restriction, it just makes me crazy.
Chairman, I'm Representative Nelson. Well, absolutely. We look when we look at the economic viability of Oregon or an individual community, it's not so simple as to look just at the tax implications. We also have to be concerned about the availability and capacity of our workforce to meet the needs of business, the access and availability of our transportation systems, as you mentioned, and, of course, the underlying education system to create that flow of educated and skilled workers. Going back to the transportation, as you know, the previous legislative sessions have creatively provided funding that's making vast investments in improving the highway system within Oregon in the OTIA. I think I'm not sure I'll get this exactly right, OTIA 1 and OTIA 2 in terms of investments, particularly improving the bridges which have constrained truck transportation. There is a proposal that's currently circulating in the legislature for, and it's supported by the governor, called Connect Oregon, which would utilize up to $100 million in the form of lottery-backed bonds that would be used to invest in intermodal type transportations that would be marine, rail, aviation, and mass transit. And I think the logic there being that we've made some very significant investments in our highway transportation system, or it's in the process right now. The next step in keeping that transportation system competitive is to make those connections between the highway, the marine, the rail, airport access, and obviously mass transit, which moves the people to and from the job. So I think that effort is underway, and that might be a topic for the committee to consider. It's the Connect Oregon proposal.
We should hear that. Yeah.
Okay. Vice Chair Broom.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Real quick, I just want to compliment Representative Nelson. I think she is exactly right in the point she's making with this number of 10. First of all, I compliment this bill. It's the right thing to do. It's the right thing to expand it. But I think having 10 is arbitrary. Point being, if you're number 11 on the list and you absolutely qualify from a economic hardship perspective, yet you don't qualify, it seems unfair and arbitrary. If we limit it to 10, we limit our ability to create new jobs in Oregon, which seems like the thing we don't want to do as a board. And something, especially with the e-commerce zones, I think it's always important to remember, because Oregon does not have a sales tax, we are potentially a mecca for e-commerce. As other states look to increase revenues and look to start putting their sales tax on e-commerce concerns, Oregon will become more and more attractive, as was the case with Google, to come to Oregon to run their business. And if we have that incentive, if we can provide the incentive with the e-commerce zones, it creates that much more incentive to create jobs. So I would say, Mr. Chair, that when we get to the point during the work session, we take strong consideration to eliminate the arbitrary 10.
Thank you. And I understand Doris Penwell, you'd like to testify on this bill? Okay. Yes.
With your indulgence, Chair Lynn, members of the committee, I'd just like to note that although this bill deals, the big issue here is the e-commerce bills, and I certainly encourage the committee to consider, whatever they like as far as other interests go. Please be aware that the second section, which is explained on the back of the page, deals with what Victoria mentioned in her presentation, the long-term tax incentives, and it extends the sunset for that program. So that's another feature in the bill that I just bear the committee in mind. There's some information there, and we can always come back with questions.
Thank you. Please stand by, and then we might call you back. And so, Doris, I'm going to come on over. Welcome, my old good friend.
Thank you, Chair.
I don't mean you're old, but a old friend.
Chair Lim, members of the committee, my name is Doris Penwell. I, for a long time, represented Economic Development Department, but I am associated with the Association of Oregon Counties, and we have a great interest in this electronic commerce bill. Over the interim, the Association of Oregon Counties worked with some other interests around the state on a series of telecommunication bills to enhance the state's economy, talk about telecommunication. The electronic commerce zones has been clearly, as indicated by the department, a great addition to bringing telecommunication companies into the state and a benefit to the localities. The counties in association with other groups supported increasing the number of electronic commerce zones. And I think they also were concerned, as legislators might be, with not just the property tax exemption that you receive in an enterprise zone, but also because an electronic commerce zone has the additional tax credit issue associated with it. It's not just a local decision as to whether, the implications are not just local, as to whether you will forego some property tax in order to allow an electronic commerce designation within your enterprise zone. So I think folks have been careful about getting into the business of the electronic commerce zones and the tax credit implications as well as property tax. So when we first dealt with the electronic commerce zones and were worried about what the impact would be, it was limited to 4 plus 1 areas of the state so that we could experiment with how this might work. It has been very successful. And locales around the state would like to participate, as with the four that have already been designated. I think that's why the number 10 was not scientific, but a good number to consider. So it's the implication of the income tax reduction to the state that I think you need to care about. And but otherwise, if locales decide that they want to use the electronic commerce zone and apply to the state, they will provide information to the department as to whether they are a good location for this to be considered. And clearly, even with 10 enterprise zones that are eligible for electronic commerce zones, the department is under no obligation to designate all of them if the applications aren't up to snuff. So I think it is up to the legislature to decide whether the number should be 10 or 20 or 49. And that would be the right. I think the understanding that the counties would have with something like this.
Thank you very much. Any questions? Representative Dallum?
The Oregon Association of Counties, looking back on the history of the bill, mm-hmm. and this was to target high unemployment areas.
Yes.
If we were to make one enterprise zone, and that being about the size of the state of Oregon, would the Oregon Association of Counties support an amendment like that?
To make it widely available?
Yes.
I believe the Association of Oregon Counties would support that because you have to apply for the electronic commerce designation, and if local decision makers decide that they want to provide that option and give up the property tax, they would be willing to do that on the basis of the investments that come in. They are giving up the property tax receipt, but the issue here is not the property tax, it's the income tax credit that applies to, that is a statewide issue rather than just a one county issue. So that's the point I'm making about this. I believe they would support that because if they are conservative and don't want to go ahead and apply, they don't have to. And the department is under no obligation in the law now to approve all of them. So I think that's where they would stand. And of course, we would discuss that as this bill moves along.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Representative Buckley.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just to clarify or to confirm, even if there were additional enterprise zones allowed for 20, 25, or whatever the decision was, they would still have to qualify as being economically in need in order to qualify as an enterprise zone?
Mr. Chair, Representative Buckley, yes, you always have to meet the terms of the regular enterprise zone statutes, which are considerable. And we now are fully engaged in enterprise zones around the state. At some point, some of the zones become, they expire, and then others apply if they are interested. So you still have to meet all of the terms of the existing law in order to be designated.
Right. Thank you. I just wanted to confirm that.
Thank you.
It's expensive.
Thank you very much, though. It's appreciated. And is there any other person like to testify on House Bill 2234? If not, I'd like to close the public hearing on House Bill 2234. And then I'd like to...
You also have a hearing open on...
No, I'd like to work out this one first.
Okay. You also have a hearing open on 2234.
I know.
Close that hearing also.
That's still open.
Okay.
Okay. So I'd like to open a work session on House Bill 2234.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Nelson.
It is my belief that this bill, 2234, best serves the state with an amendment. And that would be to have, unlimited opportunity. My goodness, here we are just begging for new business, and we have this excellent, proven practice, that has incredible limits and, policies and procedures, and, we wouldn't even be worrying about income tax if we didn't have these businesses coming in, because we wouldn't have any, and the property tax issue also. So I just think this has been one of the few ideas that we've come up with in the legislature that has really spurred on additional industry, and I'm proud. I'm also concerned with the 2009 sunset, and I would just encourage us to look at both of those and seek an amendment.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, could I just ask, do you first approve the bill and then ask for the amendment?
Let's have a discussion first amongst us which direction we are going to move. Any other point you'd like to discuss? Yes. Representative Dallum?
Yes, I would support Representative Nelson, but I want to go back to the original notion behind enterprise zones, and that was to target high unemployment areas. And as long as that provision is maintained, I would support that amendment wholeheartedly.
Okay. We are talking about the strictly electronic commerce we are talking about at this point. All right? So. Okay, if not, what is going to be the amendment you are going to propose, Representative Nelson?
How?
Make a motion.
Could you help me,
Administrator Stimbridge? Would you like to expand, since it's currently four we have, they're asking for now total 14, so if we give them additional 10, and still they have a lot of rooms to negotiate with the additional 10.
My motion for an amendment would make that an unlimited number and move the sunset out 5 years.
Okay. What do you say, sunset what? Remove the sunset totally?
No, increase it 5 years, because we're just, when we bring these businesses in, we need to give them a chance to grow and expand, and maybe they provide incentive for ancillary businesses, in the same area.
Currently it's until 9, which means 4 years, two sessions. And then I think it's prudent if you want to go 2 or 4 or 6 years.
Uh-huh. It was my understanding this doesn't go into effect. Okay, excuse me. It says the business firm must obtain certification on or before June 30th, 2009. So I think it's such a good program that we, need not limit it to 2009. So I don't know if one amendment should come first by itself and then the second amendment recommended.
Okay.
So I guess the first amendment would be to have motion, if I could forego my previous motion, would be to have unlimited zones.
Okay. And Representative Nelson moves to move to have unlimited without having this number. And any discussions? Vice Chair Merkley.
There's a couple things I'd like to have clarified in this. One is my understanding of the sunset is not that the program, the enterprise zones, would sunset for those that had already applied and become members. And it does raise the question that I'd like to have it clarified for the committee just how long the enterprise zone endures for those who do qualify before the existing, during the existing period. If someone would be willing to clarify that.
Good.
Thank you.
Chairman, members of the committee, let's see if I can. Let me back up just a bit and say the legislature has given the authority to issue 49 enterprise zones across the state of Oregon. Of the 49 enterprise zones, currently 4 enterprise zones have been granted a special designation as an e-commerce zone. So our bill request was to increase that to 10 of the 49 zones eligibility. The sunset provision has been amended periodically by the legislature during the duration of the enterprise zone legislation. So a firm seeking and gaining enterprise zone benefits on or before the sunset would get those benefits for the duration of the 3-year, 4 or 5 years, or the long-term duration of up to 15 years. So it's the issuance of new provisions at the sunset that, so they would gradually, as the benefits ran their duration, would no longer, and you couldn't approve, local enterprise zones could no longer approve new applications for enterprise zone benefits.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
And Art, I should refer, Art is the person who administers this program, so really give him the chance because he does this on a day-to-day basis.
Yeah, let me see if, you know, if I can just clarify where the sunsets are in the statutes. And there are sunsets for the enterprise zones. Chair Lim, members of the committee, Representative Merkley. Sunset for the entire enterprise zone program is June 30th, 2009. At that point, we can no longer, businesses can no longer qualify new. Now, there's lots of grandfathering and other types of things that will allow companies and zones to, you know, do stuff for many years after that. But that's when the basic program expires, and there'll be no more new zones after that, and no more businesses. E-commerce designations themselves have no other sunsets other than the regular sunsets of 2009 and the fact that the individual zone has a duration of no more than 11 years. Okay, and so that's why I was talking about recycling and how some come and go. We have to terminate this year, for example, by operation of law, and we have to seek an out chance for those to be redesignated, and that kind of continues almost year to year. The sunset date referred to in Section 2 of the bill before you, House Bill 2234, refers just to the long-term tax incentive program. And the proposal, and that has had a sort of rolling sunset of every couple years, and it was extended just in the last session to where it is now. And our proposal is to extend that to June 30th, 2009, along with the rest of the system. And if that was to be extended further, it should probably be done in tandem with the rest of the enterprise zone system, of course. And our thought had been not to necessarily bring that before the legislature as an issue until the next session, but, you know, you're right. I mean, it does create some uncertainty down the road, even with these grandfathering provisions and so forth that are in the law.
Thank you. Mr. Merkley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. How many applications do you currently have for the electronic commerce aspect of these enterprise zones?
Why don't you about resurvey?
Resurvey
the existing zones.
You might
comment about that.
Yeah, Chair Lynn, Representative Merkley, members of the committee. If you're talking about applications by enterprise zones for e-commerce, I mean, we don't really have any outstanding. I mean, the ones that were made in 2002, some were denied and some 4 were accepted. And we would, if we had more designations, at least the current plan would just be to, you know, redo that kind of process in, for example, next year, 2006, after the bill had taken effect, if it did. If you're talking about applications by businesses that are using e-commerce, my handout listed at the bottom in three rows, the first handout that the sort of the portrait version here on for section one, at the bottom here, you can see that in 2003 we had 8 firms that qualified, 4 that qualified just this past year in 2004, and that currently there's, and I think this is still true, even though I tallied up the numbers a few weeks ago, there's 14 out there. Most of them are still happening in the Medford e-commerce zone. But that's the current one, and that can continue. That's not affected by the sunset date in the bill, which, because they're just using the standard program in effect, plus the e-commerce additional benefit. What is affected by the sunset date in the bill are things like, well, I hate to call it Google, but the O2 project and other projects. Now, the O2 project, they have plenty of time, of course, to get certified and get in the door, but, you know, down the road, that long-term program, if it continues to, you know, get these sort of extraordinary investments, which is our hope, we'd like to have perhaps a little more time and to see if it works and that sort of thing. That's why the proposal to line it up with the rest of the system is put in there.
It sounds to me like what you're saying is that in terms of the actual zones that might seek electronic commerce status, that the number you put in here was designed to pretty much accommodate what might be expected over the next couple of years.
As far as the addition and the increase, Chairman, members of the committee, Representative Berkeley, as far as the increase from 4 to 6, it was really done in a way to be conservative, to make sure that, you know, we didn't ask for too much and not get it. But as Ron, I think, indicated, we would suspect that, you know, if we had 6 more next year to designate, we would probably get a surplus of applications that we would very much like to honor, but, you know, we would be limited by statute. And again, I think as Doris indicated, there's income tax general fund implications that people will bring up in that regard if there are more designations.
Chairman, Representative Markley, let me give a different answer to that. We recently polled the existing enterprise zones and asked them if additional e-commerce zone designations were available, would you apply? And I think we got a positive response from approximately half of those zones that currently do not have an e-commerce zone designation. So that's half of approximately 45 zones. A few more indicated they possibly would, and then a number indicated they didn't intend to apply. So I guess using that as a benchmark, we might anticipate applications from maybe 20, 25 of the existing enterprise zones that do not have the enterprise zone designation. It's different between polling them for their interest and then actually having them submit all the necessary materials to make application. But that gives you at least an indication that when we poll the existing zones, approximately half of those that do not have currently an enterprise zone designation indicated to us that they would be interested in making an application.
One more follow-up.
Okay, sure. One more follow-up.
A couple of comments I'd just like you to respond to. One is, isn't there a fiscal associated with this, both maybe a piece for the state, but certainly for the cities and counties in terms of property taxes? And if so, do you have the fiscal? And we'd sure like to see it. And my second question is, is there a point of diminishing returns? If I'm, for example, Cascade Locks and I have this designation, it's something pretty special. If I'm one of 4, if I'm one of 10, maybe it's still special. But if I'm one of 20, at that point, is it, well, not that much of a selling point anymore? And so those two pieces help us understand the fiscal side of this and whether there's a point of diminishing returns on being able to actually make an have these zones make an impact if they become too commonplace.
Chairman, Representative Merkley, I'll try to respond to the second half of your question, and I will defer to Mr. Fish to let him respond to the fiscal impact, which was done based on that. In terms of that sort of special condition or characteristic, I think that that is an issue that that your committee needs to look at. But I would also say that if what we're trying to do is to raise the entire floor of the Oregon economy, that that when we choose to limit the applicability of this, there may be existing businesses within existing enterprise zones who the applicability of an e-commerce zone designation would influence their business expansion decision. These are all based on incremental increase in investment and jobs. So this is not dealing with the established investment. So I think that's the balance that the legislature has to address in terms of and I guess I'd also hearken back to the points that Victoria made when she opened her presentation. Businesses operating here in Oregon really are competing in a global market. So this isn't their view is not so much, am I competing against a business in Cascade Locks versus a business that may exist in Roseburg or Medford, but what's my competitive position with a business operating in Texas, Alabama, Kentucky, Tennessee, or even Sri Lanka, for that matter. So I think that there are those considerations, and I think that's the consideration that the legislature is given in deciding that. And a revenue forecast, a revenue impact, I'll respond.
Thank you, Ron. Chair Lim, Representative Merkley, members of the committee. Yeah, I mean, the whole question of, specialness and, limited number, that's one issue. The other is, this hardship, economic hardship thing. And they apply both, whether you're talking about enterprise zones or, these sort of special, zone, e-commerce zones. The other issue, of course, that comes up in all these discussions is this, quote, revenue. It's really more revenue impact. And we don't do that. Legislative Revenue Office does that primarily when these bills get to the Revenue Committee. The revenue impact statement for this bill is already available with respect to property taxes, which is a fairly small issue, as they've noted. This doesn't really change the enterprise zone equation with the exemption on new property that much. I haven't seen the work for the income tax yet, but again, those revenue impacts, they just look at, it as a straight, impact, anybody who uses it is just, using it, and it's a loss like an expenditure. But I think if you look back at the work that was done in 2001, it didn't happen nearly so quickly or so much. So I think that has to be taken into account. The work I try to do in analysis is to show that, there's some payback, but the official revenue impacts don't take that into account.
Senator Dicker, you like to testify on this issue?
Not 2 words,
maybe
20 words.
Coming up.
I'm taking off. You guys can stay because I'm really
okay.
Brave.
Glad to have you with us.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I really appreciate it. Ryan Deckard, State Senate District 14. My only request this committee is I've asked OEDD, and I am a little bit disappointed that they haven't worked with the folks that created, and it's Craig Berkman, and it's Jim Hill, and it's a couple others out of this Internet Commission that created these e-commerce enterprise zones. And so the request we had made to the department was before we start altering it, and it sounds like I just heard a bit of the suggestions sound good, but I think, and I would ask that you hold this bill until the department goes and talks to Mr. Berkman and Mr. Hill and a couple others that were instrumental in creating this program about the changes that they foresee for e-commerce enterprise zones.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, could I ask the Senator a question?
Okay.
Before it was over here. Senator Eckert, would it make sense for us to send this on to the Revenue Committee for that input, or are you suggesting it makes more sense to hold it here?
Mr. Chair, Representative Merkley, whatever the desire of the committee, I had told my friends at OEDD over the summer and into the fall that I think it'd be incumbent upon them and that they come and work with if there's changes that are being thought of to this e-commerce enterprise zone, which I feel some investment in. I think it's a program that has worked, that has shown from Roseburg to Medford, who's really utilized it, even up north. I think it's a program that has obviously incredible merit, but I also think that there's that you work with folks that have some investment in it, and I know Mr. Berkman, I talked to him a few weeks ago about this because he's heavily invested as one of the folks that were like thought up, and a couple others that were working on the Internet Commission, and would really like to see the department follow the logical progression of working with those folks to talk about what their hopes would be for the program. And so if the committee wants to move it on to revenue, I would support that, but I think maybe even a better step would be to just hold on to it for a few days or for a week and ask our friends at the department to reach out to the folks that really have some initial investment in this program.
For the information, this is the subsequent referral to the revenue already, so we are just passing out to the revenue committee, not to the floor.
Can you refer to the Senate Revenue Committee?
Okay. House, the subcommittee. If you want to take it to Senate, that's fine.
Representative Nelson, you have a question?
I was going to ask the senator, you know, we can continue going back and, you know, ages. I had one for Senator Yee yesterday and a few days ago. But, you know, life goes on, and I don't know what these, you know, two individuals are doing now. I think what we have is a program, and in my opinion, as long as I've been here, this is the first time I've seen one that has really worked. And in our desire to immediately get all these people employed, and of course I'm also concerned about all these veterans, 10,000 of them coming back needing jobs, so anybody that can, you know, build a business to employ people right now is so incredible. I just don't want us to delay. And, you know, when something is working this well, already proven, been through lots of nitty-gritty, you know, it's my hope that we don't always have to go back and find the authors to say, is it okay, we move forward. And I think we already have a proven package here. It's great.
Great. Thank you.
All right. Any other questions on? Okay.
Yes. Chairman, let me ask. We've had a lot of different testimony here, and there's a lot of various directions your staff could go, and we can just hold on and wait for economic development to comment, as has been suggested. It sounds like there are some members who would like to change this number 10 to some larger number. It'd be nice if we knew what that number was. And there was also some opinion that all restrictions should be taken out of that. So another option would be just to take out the limitation in the statutory language. So we'd like some direction on that. And
that was my motion.
We can do all three of those as amendments for you to consider when you bring this back.
Okay. This is the formal move, and this is still time for discussion. Any other Representative Riley?
No, I just wanted to say I thought we had a motion on the table.
Yeah, this is a discussion time.
We need to move on.
Representative Nelson, your motion is to make it unlimited as far as the number.
Right.
Unlimited.
Unlimited. Okay. And Representative Buckley.
It still can be restricted by, yeah, you know, the department. Thank they don't
chair.
Qualify. So.
Just to kind of clarify that, we have 49 enterprise zones designated, so it would be unlimited, or it would be up to 49? And it would have to qualify within the existing structure of an enterprise zone?
Yeah, we're not changing the original structure for enterprise zones.
Okay. Mr. Chair.
Vice Chair Bruin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would, just in response to Representative Buckley's query there's rumor has it that there's movement afoot to expand the limit of enterprise zones, the whole enterprise zones. So I would just advocate that if we are considering changing the number of e-commerce zones, instead of putting a number on it, i.e. 49, we let it match the state limit to enterprise zones. If that stays at 49, then it, by definition it's 49. If it moves to 55, then it's 55.
Makes sense.
So we don't have, so there's not a potential conflict between the two in this potentially.
Okay. Vice Chair Mockley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a number of conflicting feelings about this, but I feel like the proposal is a very interesting proposal. It's essentially to say, why distinguish between a regular enterprise zone and an electronic commerce zone? Why isn't a regular zone just simply automatically an electronic commerce zone? I think that the senator has come over here, made this trip to say that there's a lot of discussions and work underway that we haven't been briefed on yet to evaluate the existing structure. It seems to me this puts our committee is then putting an additional idea on the table. Why have a separate designation? Why doesn't it just become the same? I would like to ask our committee to honor the senator's request and hear from those he suggested are working on this, and have our committee then insert into the process several ideas to get response on, such as the question about the sunsets and this question about essentially making the two zones congruous, and that then we could play a much more useful role with that additional input rather than trying to make decisions on these things at this moment.
All right. So, Representative Nelson, do you have any thoughts on the proposal?
I certainly respect Representative Merkley. I've been in the legislature with him for many years. His soft-spoken way of trying to, you know, do things that are right is very respectful. I also want to respect the legislature that established this program, and I think we worked very, very hard to establish this electronic enterprise zone. And you know, we should have done it faster and quicker, and we'd have far more business. We probably wouldn't have been leading the nation in unemployment. So I'm just going to recommend that we go forward. We studied it before. We know it's right. I think Representative Byrne's been very prudent about what he said, and it's the right thing for Oregon, and I just suggest we go forward. If there's problems later, we'll hear about them in the Revenue Committee.
Representative Buckley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would just like to add my support to what Representative Merkley said. I don't feel I have enough information right now. The presentations were very good. I would certainly appreciate the time to which I would believe we're talking about a handful of days, not another session. A handful of days to look into this issue, to review the information that's been provided, so to make sure we make an intelligent decision.
Right. It is the chair's intention that we have some unanswered questions on this issue. I think it's prudent we have more information on this one, even though I honor Representative Nelson's proposal, and I want to make the formal amendment in written, and we will bring out next meeting whenever we schedule it. Yes, and then we will continue on at the time. I don't think it's an emergency at this time to pass at this moment. I think we need to move with all the information available and the final intelligent decision. So I just appreciate your cooperation.
I appreciate what you're saying, but I have a motion before the committee, so does that mean you're not we're not going to entertain my motion?
And I'd like to have a written the amendment in our hands, and then we will have a work session.
Okay, but my question is, are you not going to honor my motion?
I'm going to honor it in the next committee meeting.
I don't think we can do that under parliamentary procedure.
I'm not sure whether we can pass just a conceptual amendment, which is not that simple, and then we need to have a written amendment before we can have a work session. If it's just the simple things, we might be able to. It is the caution from the Speaker's office that when we have a conceptual amendment, is sometimes that's not advisable. We need to have a written amendment, and then we can pass it. So We can discuss it. Maybe we can pass the way you want it, and the other amendment might be coming in, so let's have a little more time to do it. There's no objection to that. Then we will hear this bill sometime next time when we schedule it, and we will bring it back for sure. So time is up, and also we will have more public hearing on the House Bill 2349 next time also. So with that, if there's no further business, we adjourn at this time.